This is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library with our guest today, Mr. John Day. Mr. Day, can you tell us something about your childhood? Were you born in Decatur?
No, I was not. I was born on the outskirts of London, England. They called it Hanwell at that time. It was a suburb of London, which, of course, is now is incorporated into London proper. And that was in 1902, April 27th. And it seems as though I was orphaned in some manner or form, and I was admitted to an orphanage in London, England, named Dr. Bernardo's Homes, at the age of 13 months, according to my records. That's the way it was. The story on Dr. Bernardo was this. In 1893, he started a home for lost children, so to speak, or waifs off the street. He had 9 children in his home at the time, and there was a knock on his door one night, and a little boy was out there, but he said he couldn't take him. And when he went out in the morning, the boy was found dead on the street. This is supposed to be a true story. I have it in print. And he swore to God that day that he would never turn another child away, and thus became what is nationally known in England and the British Empire at that time, and is to till today, Dr. Bernardo's Homes. And that is where I more or less started to live. And of course, the children come in there, and they multiply there so fast that they have to foster home them somewhere, somehow. And I was put in a foster home with 2 other boys in the village or the town of Tunbridge Wells, England. That's in Kent County in the southern part of England. It's about 60 miles out of London, straight south. And how long I was there, I do not know. But I do know that I started to school there, which they called infant school, at 3 years old. We call it kindergarten over here, so to speak. But I do recall going to the infant school with these other children. The older boy, I don't know much about him. He went to another school. But I and another little fella, we went to the infant school.
Was this a private home, or was it another institution, like an orphanage?
Private home. These 2 people, as I recall, they had a daughter, a child daughter, but had no boys, and how we come to get there, I do not know. But while I was there, the mother died. And, of course, us 3 boys were sent back to the orphanage for redistribution or whatever. But I don't recall just how long all that time was. However, the little fella below me, we called him Sonny. And when we went back to the orphanage, Sonny and I happened to be in the same dormitory at night. And he would be crying for me most of the night, as I remember. So after a while there, I was there about 6 months before they got another place for me. What happened to the other 2 boys, I do not know. However, they sent me up into Norfolk County in the little village of Feltwell to an elderly lady up there that wanted to take care of me, I suppose. Anyhow, I was up there, and how long I was there, I don't really know, but they took me back to the homes and got me in shape to ship me out of the country like they did the rest of the kids, see? Well, it seems as though, well, while I'm up at this village, let's go there. This lady took care of me in a grand shape. I went to school there, and at that time, the little jacket that people were wearing, they called the Norfolk coat, had this 2 pleats down here and a belt. Well, she made me one so I could have it to go to church. And she saw to it that I went to church pretty regularly. And her, too, as far as that's concerned. Well, how long I was there, I do not know. And eventually, as I say, I was shipped back to the orphanage to be prepared to go overseas. At first, what they do is they subscribe to people in the country to where we are going for contributions to pay for our passage. And it seems as though the next bunch was going to go to India. So they gave me a name of a woman who had contributed enough money to passage a boy to India, and they wanted me to write to her and thank her for that. Well, I was only 8 or 9 years old. I didn't know what it was all about. Anyhow, I do recall writing to her, and I got a letter back, but to this day, I don't know what happened to it. It didn't mean anything to me at that time. Well, anyway, they started running us through the doctors. Vaccination, inoculation, and all this. Well, I and another kid was scared to death of doctors, so we run away and we hid. We hid on a fire escape, up about 2 or 3 stories. And they didn't find us. That bunch was already processed, and we lost out. Well, we finally had to come down. We was tired and hungry and everything else. So the next batch was built for Canada. So, of course, we got hooked on that. And the vaccination, I still carry the 4 marks, vaccination, as they vaccine and they vaccinate in England, 4 marks. And they all took, and next thing I know, well, I'm on a train to Liverpool, England, then from there over to Canada. And, of course, it was quite a deal for me, and, well, all of us kids. We had a long train ride to Liverpool from London, then all that big ship and everything, and it was quite something. It was quite an experience. But we were nobody. We had a tag on our coat, a white tag, and told who we were and where we were supposed to be going. See, quit this. And so eventually we end up in Montreal, Quebec. And then we debark there, and then we go on a train to Toronto, which is a branch office of the same home. They have branch offices in all these countries. And of course, you know, at that time in history, the sun never set on the British Empire. And we were sent everywhere that the British Empire had control. So how long I was in Toronto, I don't know, but it was another place just like what was over in England, a big dormitory and a lot of kids. And so one day, of course, they called for me and fixed me up with some papers and had a guardian to go along with me. And we went out into Ontario, a little village called Inglewood. And we detrained there, and of course there was some people there to meet me. I didn't know who they was. I was only 10 years old then. So. And after the papers was all signed and what have you, why then they took me in the horse and buggy to the farm. I had to stay there. The orphanage has jurisdiction over you until you're 17. See, I was only 10 years old. So we got there, and of course everything was this and that, and like a kid, why anything was, you know, interesting to me. But much to my regret, I soon found out that it wasn't going to be all bed and roses. There was 2 bachelor brothers and their spinster sister. They were the remnants of a Scotch family of 12. The others had all married and gone away, and these 3 were on the homestead farm. And the youngest of those, that is the brothers, was 38 years old, I think, at that time, 34, 38, anyhow. It wasn't too long I found out that he was pretty mean. So he just beat me for any occasion. And one time, well, they had to get me to school right away too, see. So I had to go to school. Well, I walked to school. And of course it was about 2 miles cross country. I'd walked to the other side of the... Now up here they call it sections. In Canada, it's concessions. And you walk across a concession to another road, see, and there's farms, the 100-acre farms, they back up to each other. He's got 100 and I've got 100, see, we're backed up. Anyway, it's across the fields and through the woods to the school. So, I was pretty well admitted and all. Kids is kids, they all get along. But I was always hungry. I just never got enough to eat.
Even on a farm.
Even on a farm. They had pretty much control over their spinster sister and told her what to give me or what. Well, lots and lots of times I went to school with just 4 little biscuits, you know, like cup biscuits. Mm-hmm. Well, the 2 bites in each biscuit was pretty big. So anyhow, some of the kids got to noticing it, and they shared their lunch with me. And that got back to these guys that was raising me, see. Now, they were elders, deacons and elders in the Presbyterian Church. Well, that didn't set good at all, so he really beat me on that thing. Don't you ever do things like that again. But I survived, and I don't regret anything that's ever happened there.
Mr. Day, how long did you stay on this farm?
Well, I stayed there as long as I was supposed to, regardless of the problems that I thought I was having. But as soon as I knew that I could be relieved, I took off.
Was that when you were 17?
I was almost 17. I was almost 17. One of the neighbors wanted me real bad to work for him. He had had several of us boys in years past. In fact, he'd had three of us in years past. But there again, they don't stay there forever. And, of course, he had an opening for me, and he wanted me, so I went over there. And I was there with him for, about 3 years and a half. And I farmed there with him. Well, like the other fellas, I got tired of farming, and I wanted it to spread out. So I went to a small town, about 12 miles from there, about 8 or 9,000 people. And they had a tannery there. I went there and I got a job there, 35 cents an hour, and I was on my own, see? Well, in the meantime, I had bought a Model T Ford. And, of course, you had to have wheels even those days. So I stayed there. That was all winter. I stayed there the whole winter. And in the spring, I spread out again. So one of the boys that used to work for this man, this last man I worked for, George Kirkwood, he was working for the Canadian National Railway in Sarnia, Ontario. And he wrote to me and told me to come up there, and he'd get me a job there. So in May, it was in May, I headed for, this is in 22, I heads for Sarnia, Ontario. And I got up there. Well, before I went there, he was in the express office. And he got a little too handy for having packages disappear. And it seemed as though he was taking this stuff and selling it. So he was fired from there before I got there. And I didn't get to them at that time. So I had to scrounge around and get a job real pretty quick. So I finally got a job at a bridge works, not too far from where I was staying. And this was all steel. I'd never seen anything like it. I didn't know what it was all about. But I started in there as a mechanic's helper, and I was on my way, see. Well, eventually something happened there, and I didn't stay there too long, I guess. And I got another job. I got a job at the what they call the Great Lakes Navigation. And it was at a little village outside of Sarnia. Point Edward is what they called it, where the lake steamers came in there to be loaded and unloaded, see. And, of course, it was all manual, except for bringing it up out of the hold. They had the hoists for that, of course. But these ships came in loaded with stuff from way up in Duluth and all around. And Pillsbury, I've had so many bags of Pillsbury's flour, gosh. Well, outside the freight house, they would have four lines of boxcars lined up. They'd unload these boats into these various boxcars. And it was a 48-hour job all the time, going and going, 7 days a week. You could work as long as you wanted to. There was no overtime pay, but then it was pretty good pay. Well, of course, when the lakes freeze up, well, that job's done. Mm-hmm. So you got to get another job. Well, it so happens that where I lived, there was an engineer on the Canadian National that had that run the train from Toronto to Sarnia. That was his run, a little over 200 miles. That train was the International that ran from Montreal to Chicago. And his run, as I say, was from Toronto to Sarnia. Then it went under the bridge, under the water, in the tunnel, the St. Clair River, to Port Huron, Michigan, where it was picked up there and brought on around to Chicago. Well, he had a Model T Ford, but he couldn't drive it. He was scared of it. So I asked him one day, "What in the world's the matter with you? You're scared of that little car and you drive that locomotive 80 miles an hour?" He says, "John, listen." He says, "That locomotive's going to stay on that track, we hope. But," he says, "that damn Ford go anywhere." That's just his word. So when he was gone on the road, I'd drive it for his wife and what have you. So I says to him one day, I says, "Say, I'd like to have a ride with you someday on that locomotive." He says, "Well, I'll tell you. You come out to our last stop, which was a town all about like Taylorville, about 30 miles from Sarnia. He says, you get out there some way, and then he watched, and he says, if there's no officials aboard, I'll let you know, and then you come on up." So I did that three times. Very fortunate, got on every time. And I watched every move he made till we got to Sarnia. So I knew just about how to run a locomotive. All right. So finally I went back down to the railroad to see if I could get a job, and lo and behold, I got a job at what they called a roundhouse in them days, see? And all steam engines. And of course, when these steam engines come in, they have to be serviced, this and that, and the fire shook out, get all the clinkers out of it and all that, see? So I and another guy, well, the mechanic had been there for quite some time. I was a mechanic's helper there, and we had to shake these fires out and get it ready. Now, if the engine was going right on out on another train, why, we didn't have to do too much other than shake the fires and see that it had enough sand and what have you. But if they were going to stick around a while, we had to knock the fire clear out. All right. I was on the 311 shift. And one night, I was there about 3 weeks, and one night we couldn't find the old guy that was running the engines. They call him a hostler, you know. He was too old for to be on the road, so he just moved engines here and there around the yard. So this particular night, there was 9 engines waiting to be worked on. And we'd worked on 2, and it was coming on 9:30. And we'd only worked 2 units, and I thought, "By gosh, we're going to get into trouble." So I said to this guy, I says, "We'll get in trouble on this." He says, "No, you won't. That guy isn't here to move him. We can't help him." But as time went on, I got yancy. And I got up in there. I told him, I says, "I'm going to move this engine off of here and get another one up on the pit, see?" He says, "You do and you'll get fired." Well, 19, 20 years old, I didn't know anything. I couldn't see why I'd be fired. So I got up in there and I pulled the throttle and she started to roll. And, of course, I looked out the window and got so far, then I knew how to put the brake on. I braked her. And I went and got another one. Brought it up, and these are big engines, real big engines. And I no sooner got it stopped on the pit than here comes the old hostler. Just a raising cane. Well, like the guy said, he says, "You get fired." So the next afternoon I came in, no time slip. So I went to the clerk and asked him, I said, "Hey, there's no time slip for me." He says, "Your name Day?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Superintendent wants to see you." So I go see the superintendent. He says, "Day," he says, "you broke one of the most important rules on this railroad." I says, "I did." He says, "You sure did." He says, "What if that engine got away from you? Either one of them." He says, "Do you know you would have done untold damages?" I says, "Yeah, I realize that. But it didn't happen." He says, "I know, Day, but," he says, "I've got no alternative. I got to fire you. You broke one of the most important rules on this railroad." Now, I was fired. But he never did ask me how come I knew what to do in such a short space of time. Mm-hmm. So I never did tell him.
So that finished that job, but what did you do next?
Well, the old saying is, if you're hungry, you'll look for a job. Of course, I wasn't hungry, so to speak, but then I knew I had to get another job. So I went to the Imperial Oil Refinery in Sarnia. It was quite a place, oil refinery, even in those days. And I got a job there as a laborer. And that was taking a team of horses with another guy and a big dump wagon and going all around through the plant, like Staley's here, to pick up debris and what have you to take to the dump. And when it wasn't doing that, they had small tankers that sailed on the lakes. And when a ship would be shipping oil,
it would come back maybe and want gasoline or naphtha or something else. So we laborers had to go down in the hold and clean it. And what I mean, clean it. The foreman, he was a big Irishman by the name of Flaherty, and he was ever watchful that we would never get overcome by fumes. And of course, you couldn't smoke or anything down near there. Now, I wasn't smoking then those days anyhow. So he'd often holler down that we was okay, and if we answered okay, and if we didn't, why, he was right on the ball. It was a dirty job, oh my. Because, especially if it had oil, they'd throw down a bale of rags, and in no time that bale was used up, and then it was something else. But I managed to get through the winter there, and I had a pretty good job of it. And also, in a refinery like that, there's a lot of coke, where they make the gasoline in these stills. They clean them out, and it's coke. Well, they sold the coke to the employees for a reasonable rate, and it was real good fuel. So that was part of my job, too, to deliver this coke to various homes in the city of Sarnia. And, well, that petered out. Like everything else, when they get short of money, they cut off the force. In the meantime, Sarnia and Port Huron is just like Detroit and Windsor. And a lot of traffic on the river on Sundays. On Sundays in Canada at that time, everything was closed. Everything. Theaters, anything you might think of is closed. So all you got to do is just sit around and watch the boats go up and down the river or whatever you want to do. So, of course, that was my pleasure at that time, to sit on the side of the river and watch the boats go up and down. Now, that river is about a mile and a half wide at that point. And you could see so much activity over in Port Huron, Michigan. And that everything was wide open, you see. All right, half the people in Sarnia and even outside of Sarnia come in from the country would go over to Port Huron on the weekends for buy what you want or go to the show or anything. And there was two ferry boats running all the time across that river. You pay so much for your boat, and if you want to take the car, you take the car, and over there you go where you wanted to on Sunday. It was quite a thing at those times. Eventually, they built the new bridge, Blue Water Bridge. I was down here at that time in Decatur. But it's one of the busiest bridges on the border between the United States and Canada. I have been over it many times since. So I decided, well, we'll try for it here in Michigan for a job. And it unfortunately, it was in the wintertime when I came over. And I looked in the papers, looked for help wanted, and there was a foundry south of Port Huron. They called it South Park. There was a foundry down there, Holmes Foundry. And I went down there, it was on a Thursday. And the guy said, yeah, come in the morning. I think we can put you to work. So I says, well, how about starting today at noon? He says, what's the matter, you superstitious? I says, no, I'm just pretty near broke, that's all. I only had 27 cents to my name. That's all I had in the world. But my board and room was paid up in Sarnia for the rest of the week. So he says, well, he says, go out in the yard and see if you can find Charlie Cunningham and talk to him. Maybe he can put you to work. So that I did. And he put me in a gondola railway car full of pig iron. Now, if you know what pig iron is, it's quite something. He says, I'd like to have this car unloaded today. And I didn't know anything about the tonnage or anything like that then, but it happened to be a 40-foot gondola, not too big, as they are today, see. So I started in throwing pig iron out, and after a while he came back to talk to me, wondering who I was, where I was from, and all this jazz. So I told him. So after I told him that I'd only had 27 cents in my name, he pulled out a $5 bill, and he says, here, he says, take this. This will tide you over till Saturday. We pay on Saturday. I says, no, I'm all right. My boarding room's paid up, and I've got my pass on the ferry boat. It's good for a week, see. I'm all right. No, he says, take it. You might need it. So I took it. We paid on Saturday, and then, of course, I was going to move over to Port Huron. But I find out that he's a mason. And I always remember the ring which I wear right now, too. Mm-hmm. I remember the ring that he had on him. I didn't know what masonry was at those days, of course. Now, he came from Texas himself, and he's a big, tall, slender guy, about what I am now. And he said when he first came up north from Texas, guys would haven't seen each other for a long time. Why, they'd slap each other on the shoulder and say, "Hi there, you old so-and-so." He says, "You say that down in Texas, you've got to run or be fighting one of the others," if you know what I mean. So I never did forget Charlie, and he was the first guy that gave me a break in the United States. 27 cents on. So I was there for quite a little while. And then I got, either, I don't know whether I got laid off or I quit, one or the other. Anyhow, the next winter I found myself working for a cement company, making cement, which they made there in port here in Michigan, and they loaded into boats to be shipped all over around. And this particular winter they were building more silos to hold cement in storage. And I got a job there. They built these in the wintertime, and back in those days they did not have chemicals to put in concrete like we do now to keep it from freezing. But what they did, they had a scaffold all around it, and a safety bars and canvas. Then they had a steam pipe inside of that to keep the concrete warm. And every day my job was with a wooden trowel to smooth all the rough spots on the side of them silos. That took care of my winter that time. Warm at that. Well, things go along there, and I don't know whether I quit or got fired, or laid off or what. But the next place I find myself working for an automobile factory, which was further south of Port Huron than South Park, at least by the name of Marysville.
What year was that, Mr. Day?
This was in 1924. They're building a car down there called the Will St. Clair. Whether you ever heard of it or not, I don't know. This man, Wills, C.H. Wills, was chief engineer for either Chrysler or Ford. I don't recall which. But he invented the overhead camshaft, and he wanted them to use it in their automobile. But they rejected it. He says, "Okay, I'll just build it myself." So he builds this factory at Marysville and has all of the materials shipped up by truck from Detroit. Now, I say shipped up by truck. Those old trucks in those days were chain drive with solid rubber tires. They did pull a trailer, the same rubber tires, and he had to haul that all up to this factory in order to assemble it. The first job I had there was putting on and balancing balloon tires. That was way back there. Those balloon tires were something in their day, of course. So this Will St. Clair turned out to be a very popular car for the rich people. The cheapest car at that time, the Roadster, was $3,800, FOB. And I put the tires on for quite a while, and then I got a chance to go to the paint shop. I heard there was a lot of overtime there, so there I go. And I worked there for quite a while. I finally worked myself down to the final end where the cars go out the door. Well, before they get to the door, the main door to go out, they've been through this and through that, and there's a scratch here and a scratch there. So my job was to touch up these patches. I had, maybe 15 different colored paints, see? And it was quite a job. But I noticed a lot of cars came to Bloomington, Illinois, and I couldn't imagine a town by the name of Bloomington. Just an odd name, see? But the majority of the cars were shipped down to Florida. There was a big boom in Florida in the 20s, see? Mm-hmm. A lot of them went to Florida, and a lot of them went to Argentina. A lot of them. It was crated up, shipped by boat to Argentina. In 1925, kind of slacked off. They weren't selling so good. The rumor was that they were going bankrupt. So, incidentally, I got married in the 25th day of June, 1925.
Where did you meet your wife, Mr. Day?
In Port Huron, Michigan. She was a Canadian girl. Mm-hmm. And we got married the 25th day of June. And we bought a new Chevrolet Roadster between us, new car, at that time. The rumor was, as I said, that they were going to fold up, but they eventually did in 1926. Anyway, my wife's uncle at that time was an official on the Grand Trunk Railroad, although I didn't know it. And after we was married, and I didn't know this either at that time, he and three other officials were brought down to Decatur to the Wabash from the Grand Trunk Railway in Fort Hood, Michigan. So he came back up there to visit, and we was talking about the place folding up and all. He says, okay, he says, come on down to Decatur and I'll put you to work. He was at that time superintendent of the car shops here in Decatur. So over the 4th of July, 1926, we came down to Decatur. I came through Bloomington, Illinois. And what is now Route 51 was then Route 10. And we got to Decatur, and of course we stayed with them for a while until we got rooms. So the 5th day of July, I went to the Wabash Hospital, 8 o'clock in the morning, to be examined. 10 o'clock that morning, I was in the steel plant, bucking rivets. So, of course, my line was a painter, really. Mm-hmm. So eventually I got to be a painter on the Wabash and was there for quite a while.
So that began a long career with the Wabash Railroad, I presume. How long did you stay with the Wabash?
I was with the Wabash until we merged with the Norfolk and Western, which was in October 16, 1964. In 1958, after being a painter at the car shop, both boxcars and coaches, I painted the Bluebird many a time, the Cannonball. I got a chance to be a foreman over at the locomotive shop in the paint shop, so I accepted that. That was in October 1958, and I stayed there until I retired on November 28, which is today, actually today. It was on a Tuesday, 1969. That I and the machine and the pipe shop foreman retired at the same time.
Well, you must have enjoyed your work there, is that right?
You betcha. You betcha. I wouldn't take $1 million for anything I've done and had.
Can you tell us why the Wabash was such a great railroad?
In my opinion, the Wabash was a great railroad because of the personnel. Now, I don't care what some people might say, that's bunk. No. It's the personnel that makes a railroad, or anything, even your home and your family. It's personnel. The attitude of the employees towards the company, to one another. I don't regret anything I've ever said or done with the employees or whatever. Incidentally, when I went over to the car, to the locomotive shop from the car shop, there was a painter over there that used to work at the car shop but didn't really think too much of me. He was on the paint gang. And when I went over there, he says, Jack, they called me Jack. It was Jack Day, see. He says, Jack, he says, you may as well start being a heel right now. Those weren't the words he said, but that's what the gist of it is. Because we're going to make one out of you, and I'm going to help. So the day I left, he came over to me, and he says, Jack, he says, I don't know why, but he says, we never got that job done. I said, what are you talking about? I knew, but I wanted him to spell it out. He says, you know what I'm talking about. I says, well, I'll tell you, Harlan. In the first place, I've traveled around a bit. I consider myself a man. I'm a churchman, a deacon, and I'm a mason. Now, if those ingredients won't make a man out of anybody or keep him from being a heel, as you say, then there's no hope. Well, that's the way it was at that time. And, of course, other fellows have come to me and said that I really was more than what they expected.
What do you think of the railroads today, Mr. Day?
The railroads are having a hard time, like any other company that has employees. Now, when I came to Decatur, it was 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. We thought nothing of it. Many a payday, my payday was $45, maybe a few cents more, for 2 weeks. We had money to burn in those days. They're getting more than that at peace, a day now, each man. There's too much, we got to have unions, understand. They've got their place, but they are too big and powerful today. Look at your coal mine situation right now. They're just too big and powerful. I started to work at the Wabash for 39 cents an hour. Today, that job pays $7.18 plus fringe benefits. Now just think, the company has to pay all that. And they do not get the production that they did in the years past. I know that because I was a supervisor, and I know. Mm-hmm. That's really what's happening to the railroads. They're being torn apart too much. For instance, years ago, 100 miles was a day's work for the roadmen. Well, what's 100 miles today? See? 100 miles from here to St. Louis, 113 miles by rail here to St. Louis. That was a day's work. Of course, they do that now in 2 hours, see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's hurting the railroads and other industries. Look at your steel workers. Well, they're folding up, see? Mm-hmm. The unions have just got too big for their britches.
It seems as if the roadbeds are a problem, doesn't it?
Well, what brought that about is this. With a steam engine, if you know anything at all about a steam engine, I'm sure you do know some. A steam engine has those counterbalanced wheels and your side rods, see?
Mm-hmm.
That's where they get their motion. They're heavy on the rail. They pound in the rail, see?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever that counterbalance comes down, it's a pounding on the rail. They had to keep them up then. They had to. Now, the diesel runs like an automobile. And it just glides along,
mm-hmm.
see? The tie's rotting out, but they don't probably take too much interest in the tie's. And that is where they start to go, see?
Mm-hmm.
All right, the rail will give where there's a bad tie, mm-hmm. and that just continues until it's fixed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you've seen some trains going through here or out of Decatur, but I have seen them on a double track where they'd be swaying,
mm-hmm.
the cars would touch each other on the tops.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, some of them probably did. Just that much swing.
Mm-hmm.
On the part of the railroad, too, but the idea was, as long as they can run,
mm-hmm.
we'll run.
What about passenger trains? Is there ever going to be any future for passengers again?
I never thought I would see the demise of the steam engine, let alone a passenger train. Never in my life did I ever dream of that. However, they're both gone. And Amtrak, as hard as they're trying and as much as it's costing, in my opinion, that will never make it because they are at the mercy of the railroads. Now,
mm-hmm.
if they had been thinking years back when they spent the government, mind you, spent all this money for transcontinental highways,
mm-hmm.
if they'd have thought then what they know now, they would have, I would think, they've worked up these tracks
mm-hmm.
and kept these intercity mm-hmm. trains. Because they've got the motors 55 mile an hour
mm-hmm.
on the superhighway, which
mm-hmm.
you can go 80 mile an hour just like that, see?
Mm-hmm.
The cars are built for it. They're just sitting there now, just waiting for somebody to tear them up or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame that they've cut it down to 55 in a way, because after all, it's not the automobile. It's the nut behind the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
These automobiles that are the safest thing that ever was created.
Mm-hmm.
You can drive in it for days and hours and never feel tired. It's like riding in a Pullman.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, if I had the money and I was in the White House, if they would just take some more money now, take one side of all these interstates, one side, lay a railroad track and have their intercity trains
mm-hmm.
other than the railroad, see, that'd be the government.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have their passengers, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Day, let's go back a bit, and why don't you tell me, did you ever go back to England?
Oh, yes, I did. I was in the National Guard here in Decatur for a long, long time. I joined the National Guard in April 1927, and was with it right clear up till we mobilized for World War II. I was hoping then, of course, that we would get to go to England, but unfortunately the 33rd Division went to the Pacific Theater. I did go back to England in September 1959. I have one son, And he was working with Douglas Aircraft out in Santa Monica, California. He'd been with them for quite a while. He was sent over to England to help set up the Thor missiles, which they were doing at that time. And he was staying at Mildon Hall Air Base in Norfolk County, which was just about 3 miles from the village of Feltwell, where I was last staying. So I wrote and told him that was where I was last staying. I didn't think he knew about that. And he went to town on his own time, and it's a little village, perhaps like Blue Mound, maybe not that big now. And he ran across two ladies that said they went to school with me there. And, of course, he told them why he was there and all about it. So nothing else would do but I had to come over there and have a visit, even if he had to pay for it. Well, I wasn't going to let him pay for it, so I told him I would come over. So I was a supervisor, of course, at the locomotive shop at that time, and I had to square it up with the officials. And they said I could have the last half of September. So the 18th day of September, I got on an airplane at O'Hare Field, and pretty soon I was in London, England. And Jack was there to meet me. He had a friend with him that was working with him out there, and we went around different places and got a motel or a hotel. I stayed at the Mont Blanc, I think it was, hotel. Quite a big hotel, anyhow. We stayed there, and of course, I stayed in London 4 days. He had to go back up to work on Sunday evening. He took the train up to wherever it was, Mildon Hall. And I stayed in London for 4 days. I wanted to look around. I went to where I used to stay in the orphanage. And, of course, I went to Hyde Park, where they used to stand on soapboxes, and they still do to this day, and argue this and that. And, of course, I had to ride the subway, which they call the tube. And it was quite easy to get around. Everything comes back to you. You see, I was 10 years old when I left there, and I remember quite a bit of it. The second day there, I was standing on the street, and four ladies come up to me and asked me if I knew what time the next bus left for Soho. Well, Soho is a night spot. And I said, well, I'm sorry, ladies, I just got in here myself. So right away, they knew they wasn't talking to no Englishman, although I could throw that lingo out if I want to. And they were from Boston, and they were on their way to Rome, and we visited a little bit, but that was it, so... So I rode around in London, and then I took the train to Tunbridge Wells. I wanted to see that again. So I went down to Tunbridge Wells, and I went to the little school where I was an infant. Mm-hmm. I had with me a certificate that I had gotten at that time from the County of Kent Education Committee. I had had a 87% attendance out of 100, and it was a pretty nice certificate. Jack's got it now out in California. So I went to this school, opened the door, and there sat a lot of children just like me back in 1989 when I was there. And there sat these children. At that time, I was hard of hearing. I had hearing aid on my eyeglasses. And the kids was noticing that. I could see the kids pointing to it. Isn't that... So, usually you hear of the schoolmaster in England. All right. This happened to be a school ma'am this time. So I told her who I was and why I was there and showed her the certificate. And it was signed by the schoolmaster at that time, Mr. Kirby. She said, I'm sorry that you waited so long because Mr. Kirby died in April.
Yeah.
And this was in September. So from there, from the school, I went down to the railroad station and in the yards and see what I could find out about steam engines and all this and that. I took some pictures of the steam engines, and they were still running them there. One interesting thing about the railroads in England that I didn't know then, but I know now, they have no headlights on the locomotives. No headlights. Everything is run by signal. No matter where you go in the whole country, it's signal. And I thought it was quite unique. And also, any railroader that knows what I'm talking about, they do not even yet have only a few automatic couplers. It's pin and link.
Mm-hmm.
And you raise the link up and hook mm-hmm. it, and they put the pin in it. And it's something else. But these steam engines over there, they've got 80-foot drivers, possibly 84-inch drivers, and they go like the dickens.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something. Also, there are so many tunnels in England, they'd be anywhere from 3 to 5 miles long, some of them. And also, there is no grade crossings.
Mm-hmm.
So they just got a time schedule and they keep it. That's what they do. So I came back to London and I got ready to go up to where Jack was. So I didn't know too much about their trains. First class, see, they got so many cars, first mm-hmm. class, second class, third class, depends who you are and what you are, where you can ride. I didn't know that. Anyhow, I got on this one train, and I got in. Now, the coaches over there, you don't go to the end of the car to get off. You just open the door anywhere on the side of the mm-hmm. car, and you just roll out. Now, I found out afterwards why that was so. There is so much commuter traffic over there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they waited for everybody to get off at one end or the other, they'd never get mm-hmm. where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
So there might be 5 or 6 or 7 doors on one car on both sides, see?
Mm-hmm.
And they just open the door
mm-hmm.
and go in. I was sitting there and I was talking to a fella. He was going up to Cambridge. And when he saw I was from the States, why, we got talking, and he said, I had a daughter that was an exchange teacher in Vermont. And he was quite interested to me and I to him, see, different thing. Well, he got off at Cambridge, but before we got there, here comes the conductor. And he looks at my ticket, he says, what are you doing in here? I says, well, I'm on the wrong train or what? He says, you're in the wrong car. He wasn't anyways nice either. I thought, well, at least you could be mm-hmm. sober about it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, he says, you either go to another car or pay me 3 shillings. Well, 3 shillings are just 75 cents.
Right.
I said, well, I'll give you the 3 shillings. That'll help you any. Because I thought, well, if you can be rough, I can too. So when he left, the fellow that got off at Cambridge, he says, he didn't have to act like that. I said, well, no, I didn't think he did either. But anyhow, that's that. So I got up to Ely. Ely was the junction where I would have to get off the train and go to where Jack was. Now, I went to the what they call the Bachelor Officers' Quarters, BOC. And I stayed there all the time I was there for $1 a day, board and room. And, of course, Jack, he was stationed there, too. So we got along pretty good. We was off. He gets off Friday afternoon. He had a company car. He gets off Friday noon, and he and another fella from California and I, we start out with the little car, little Austin. Jack, he got intrigued with the cathedrals. He wanted to see the cathedrals. So we took in some cathedrals. We went to Bury St. Edmunds, a very popular town in Norfolk County. And before we got there, though, we passed through a little town. I can't think of the name right now. Anyhow, it seems to be the home of the author of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Mm-hmm. That was where he was born.
Mm-hmm.
And the houses in that place are crooked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether they were built that way on purpose or that the people didn't know any better, we don't know to this day, at least I don't. But it was quite... And I had my picture taken there with a crooked house on Water Street. So, all in all, it was quite an adventure to be over there. We went to Falwell to see these two ladies, but one of the ladies was on what they call over there, we call it vacation, they call it holidays.
Mm-hmm.
They do in Canada, too, mm-hmm. it's still holidays. Mm-hmm. But I only saw the one. So I didn't see too much of the family either.
Mm-hmm.
But her boy was in the Air Force in England mm-hmm. during the war, the Battle of Britain. He lost his left arm in the Battle of Britain as a pilot. And he could tell us some of the history of that area that was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And his penmanship was so beautiful. The light stroke and the dark stroke mm-hmm. up and down. It was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. We wrote back and forth for quite a bit. And I was hoping that I could have got a piece of parchment paper and had him write the Lord's Prayer mm-hmm. on it. But I never did get that done.
But you really enjoyed going back to England.
I should say. There I was, up in the air from O'Hare, 10 hours, it took 5 days, years back to come across the Atlantic, 10 hours I was in London, England.
Mr. Day, you must be really enjoying your retirement, are you?
I sure am. I'm still painting.
Well, you're not painting locomotives now, are you?
No.
What are you painting?
I am painting the Wabash flag for anyone that wants it. I have all the patterns. In fact, if you will recall that all the passenger trains used to have a drum on the back car signifying what train it was, like the Bluebird, the Banner Blue, the Cannonball, or what have you. Not only the Wabash, but other railroads in the country. And of course, when the Wabash turned over to the N&W, the taillight signs were done away with. And the paint foreman at the car shop was told to dispose of all the Wabash material and so on. I happened to go over there one day, and lo and behold, the patterns were going to the dump. I grabbed them, and I still have them to this day. I have 37 or 32 Wabash patterns up in my attic of taillight signs. Now, I also have specials. They made a lot of specials. They put the flag in the middle, see? And it was a special, whether it was a Shrine special or a Ford dealer special or a Buick or what have you, that's the way it was. And I have them all up there. And I started making the flags on small pieces of plexiglass for my friends. And I sell quite a few of them. Mm-hmm. They are 8 by 10. I sell them for $5. Mm-hmm. And if they're bigger, why, it costs a little more.
These are railroad buffs who like to collect items.
That's right. Anyone, you know, that had a part of the Wabash, their family, their grandfather, or their father, or what have you. Some fellows in Moberly, they sent over and they wanted the flag painted and also the date that they went into service and the date that they retired with their name underneath. So I've made quite a few of them. Now I could make that flag either from 8 by 10 up to 28 inches in diameter, which I've got all the patterns and it's all done by pattern. When I do it on plexiglass or even glass, we used to put it on plate glass, but they get broke so easily. You've got to do it upside down and backwards. So you got to kind of know what you're doing. But the end product is just beautiful.
Well, that must be very satisfying. I know you have some other interests too. You write poetry, don't you?
Yes, I wrote poetry. I don't know when I got started on that. I suppose back in my days of romance I got started on that, but it isn't too much problem for me to just sit down. If I've got a good subject, I can write a pretty good poem, like I rewrote the Cannonball.
Why don't you give us a verse or two of this? Could you do that?
I will. You want the whole thing?
Oh, I might as well.
The Cannonball. This was written in the 14th day of March, 1971. There's a train that's still a-running, and it's serving one and all. 'Tis known throughout the country, it's the Wabash Cannonball. She rolls right through the prairie on the state of Illinois, with her sore beams and coins so tall. Yes, sir, it's the Wabash Cannonball. She starts in old St. Louis, through the woodlands by the shore of the muddy Mississippi, with its history galore. It pauses at Decatur for an engine chain and crew, change and crew. Going on to Danville, the next stop will be Peru. To Fort Wayne and then Detroit, that's as far as she can go. She used to pull the mail through rain, sleet, hail, and snow. And she's had her share of hobos. Some were short, some were tall, but they all had one thing in common, for they rode the Cannonball. Many a man has pulled the throttle off this famous train, and when he had to leave her, his heart was filled with pain. But he knew she'd keep on running, for he has heard the country's call to save this thing of beauty, the Wabash Cannonball.
Oh, that's really lovely, and it does bring back a lot of memories, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It certainly does. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have other interests, I know. The Masons, for example?
I joined the Masons in 1954. I never did forget the guy in Fort Huron, Michigan, Charlie Cunningham. And I was leaving for Tucson, Arizona, on a vacation, wife and I, and a brother Mason handed me a application. He says, John, I'd like you to fill this out, if you will. So when I came back, I had it filled out and gave it to him. And of course, I'll never regret it. Mm-hmm. After I was raised a brother Mason, I told a story briefly as to how it all began, which all candidates have a privilege of doing when they become raised as a third degree Mason. And of course I went from a third degree over to Springfield at the consistory, a 32nd degree Mason and a Shriner. We do great things. It costs, so what? Can't take it with you? The good things that the Shriners do can never be duplicated any way, shape, or form.
And you have all that good companionship too.
Yes, and I play in the band. I'm not a musician, don't care to read a note of music, but I play the bass drum and have since 1958. Two things you've got to have in a band is a bass drummer and a trumpet. And of course I keep the beat, so I'm musically inclined. But first I was in the Home Guard in Canada, and I joined the Kilty outfit there, and I think about 3 weeks I got to play on a snare drum. So I was real tickled with that. I often wished I could have kept my kilts, though, but I didn't.
What tartan was it? Do you remember?
I do not. I didn't know that much about the tartan at that time.
Do you have any other hobbies that you'd like to mention? You mentioned your family. You have a son in California now.
I just had the one son. In California. He is now living in Arizona, and he works in Nevada. He was with Douglas Aircraft for 23 years in aerospace. And of course, when they got caught up on that, he, along with hundreds of others, were discharged. And he now works for a combustion company that makes the electricity for Los Angeles and Orange County in Nevada, just across the river from Arizona. He lives in Bullhead City. Now, he's a railroad buff, too. He has got a Wabash Bell off a steam engine, 2900, out there, and he's got a pot-belly caboose stove. He's got a lot of railroad relics. Mm-hmm. He has been offered over $500 for either the bell or the stove, but he will not part with them. No, he will not indeed. Well, I keep busy with my neighbors. I'm always doing something for my neighbors.
What do you think about Decatur? Do you have any thoughts about the city itself?
Decatur? I've always liked Decatur. Just recently, I had to finish 6 years on the Parking and Traffic Commission, which put me in touch with many of the problems of Decatur, especially in the traffic and parking department. Decatur is to be pitied in a way right now. I feel sorry for Decatur due to that big shopping mall going up at Forsyth. It is one of the sad parts of the history of Decatur. Kresge's is leaving across the street. There's going to be empty stores in Decatur, so help me, I can't see anything else. However, we have to move on. They say that's progress, knocking down that high school. I can't see any progress there, really. But that's the way it goes. What is to be has always been my belief. What is to be will be. Will be, no matter what it is.
But you think Decatur has been a good place for you to live?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. As I said before, I got into the Guards, enjoyed every bit of it. We've had our problems, called out on duty several times. 1937, we went down to Shawneetown where they had the big flood. The river had overflowed 13 miles. We just can't imagine those sort of things here nowadays, but that was the case at that time. And you just don't kind of believe those sort of things. In other words, you can talk to children nowadays about steam engines, and they just don't, they can't visualize them because they've never seen them. Everything's up in the air now. I was coming back from California one time by myself, and I got the last seat. And lo and behold, here I was a Shriner, and they put me there between two priests. So I said to those two guys, I says, well, I guess I'll be on good behavior this time. So the one guy says, well, we won't bother you. And then they did not. I tried to converse with him. The first thing I said, well, it looked like all the passenger trains are up in the air now. And he never said boo. So I just went to sleep.
Well, you really have been an inspiration for people who are looking forward to retirement, or maybe even some of those who are dreading it. I think that you really have seem to have been enjoying not only your life, which has been very, very full and very rewarding, but you seem to be enjoying your retirement too.
Very, very much so. I'm blessed with good health. I had a heart attack 4 years ago today, this very day, Tuesday. I had a heart attack, and it was pretty severe, I guess. For 4 hours at St. Mary's, they didn't know whether I was going to make it or not, but the good Lord don't take it till he's ready, and I made it. And, I've got perfect health so far.
Well, the Lord had more plans for you then.
He may have.
Well,
go ahead. I don't think I mentioned the fact that after being robbed of going into the service at the time in 1941, that I joined the Civil Air Patrol then, which was an auxiliary of the Air Force. I joined it in an administrative capacity. I had been supply sergeant in the Guards for 10 years, and I knew a little bit about paperwork, so I would join the Civil Air Patrol, and finally I got to be company commander here, squadron commander, rather, and then on to group commander, which we had 5 squadrons, and I got to the rank of captain, which gave me the privilege of anything that the Air Force had. So I enjoyed every bit of that, too. A lot of flying. I done a lot of flying. But never did become a pilot.
But you have certainly had your share of wonderful experiences. And we thank you for sharing them with us, too.
It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening to the experiences of Mr. John Day, recording for the Decatur Public Library. This is Betty Turnell.